So you're different. But if that's the case, why, and we all understand that theologically, but if that's the case, why do we need passages like Colossians 3 to come along and tell us to stop sinning so much? I mean, why is there so much sin still in my life if I'm such a new creation? Well, the answer that Paul gives is because of the flesh. In Romans 7:18, he says, I know nothing good lives in me, that is in my flesh, for I have the desire to do what is good, but I can't carry it out. And in verse 25, he says, I myself, in my mind, am a slave to God's law, but in the flesh, I'm a slave to the law of sin. So it's because of the flesh. You're rid of the old man completely, but you still sin now because of the flesh. And in this life, you can't get rid of the flesh. You eradicated the old man, but you cannot eradicate the flesh in this life. It's always going to be present there. So the best you can do is learn how to dominate the flesh. The whole question of sin in the life of the believer is this. Is your flesh going to dominate your mind, or is your mind going to dominate your flesh? And that will determine the path you take with regard to sin. So we need to gain control over the flesh. Well, how do you do that? How do you gain control over your flesh? First, we have to define what flesh is. Your flesh, and it's a little bit difficult to define, but I think you can say it this way. Your flesh, theologically speaking, is that part of you that is connected to this world. Your flesh is that part of you that can't see or apprehend the spiritual realm. It can only appreciate the physical world. It's your eyes, your physical eyes, your nerve endings, your senses, every part of you that is not able to be aware of the spiritual realm. It can only apprehend the physical realm. That's your flesh. And no matter how spiritual you are, no matter how godly you become, no matter how righteous in this life, your flesh will always be exerting a negative influence on you until you die. It's the flesh that your physical eyes and your physical ears and your senses and your appetites and your weaknesses, that's what causes sin to look attractive to you and causes righteousness sometimes to look unattractive. When you see a person who is beautiful and who is not your spouse, it's the fact that your body is limited to the physical perspective that draws you towards adulterous desires in that case. If your eyes could somehow see the spiritual realm and you were sensitized to that, the adulterous thoughts wouldn't even be a temptation because you could see it for what it really is. It would be ugly. That's why the righteous life is so easy right after a profound worship service at church and so difficult on a Friday afternoon after a whole week of being exposed to temporal perspectives. Your perspective determines your perception. Now, highlight that in your thinking. You may not know what I mean by that for a second, but just think about that thought. Your perspective determines your perception. You know, I heard about a study about some chickens, and I think I've got to try to remember this right, but I think what they did with these chickens is put glasses on them so that everything appeared closer than it actually was. It's just like your side mirror on your car. Objects are actually closer than they appear. That's the way everything was for these chickens with these glasses on. And so when they would try and eat, they would come up and they would miss the corn or whatever they're trying to eat. It would be sitting there and they'd be pecking right here. It took a while, but they finally were able to orient themselves so that they could go right to the food. They adjusted in their brains. But when they took those glasses off the chickens, it was interesting. They could not get back to perceiving it correctly. Their brains had changed, and now they couldn't eat, and they would just starve because they would overreach. The grain would be right here, and they'd be pecking out here. They just couldn't convince themselves that the grain was actually where it actually was rather than where their senses told them it was. That's exactly the function of your flesh. Your flesh works just like that. Looking at things from a purely human standpoint, a physical way, just physical, for several days in a row, makes everything appear different than the way it actually is in reality. In reality, sin is actually very disgusting and ugly and repulsive. When you see sin for what it really is, you're always repulsed by it. But looking through these eyes only over a period of time distorts your perception so that suddenly you don't see things the way they really are. Instead, sin starts to look attractive and righteousness starts to look unattractive. And then that's when the the Christian life becomes hopelessly difficult, impossible. Because righteousness is actually exciting and wonderful and attractive. But operating at a mere physical level over a period of time makes it look stuffy and boring. If you spend several days at a time thinking on a natural level, just staring at the earth right in front of your face, you will become nearsighted. You'll go from that, and then you come on a Sunday and try and look up towards heaven, you won't even be able to focus. You don't live your life based on what you know to be true. You live your life based on what seems true to you. And the fact that the reason I know that for sure is because we all know in our heads that the momentary pleasure we get from sin is not worth the consequence, right? I mean, we understand that. There isn't anybody in this room who disagrees with that. And yet everyone in this room still sins. Why? Why do we choose to sin? Why do we get to the point where we're tempted and we cave into a temptation and decide to sin even though we know in our heads that the pleasure we get from it is not worth the cost? Why do we do that? Because you don't make decisions in life based on what you know to be true. You make decisions in life based on what seems to be true to you. And at the moment of temptation, that sin seems like it's worth it. And we make our decision based on the way things seem. So after a wonderful worship service or some moving sermon or the end of a whole week at some retreat, church retreat, you find that it's very easy to resist certain temptations. Certain temptations that when you're at work are almost impossible for you to resist. And the reason is because after several days in that context of thinking about things from a spiritual, biblical perspective, your vision starts to correct a little bit. You start to see things as they really are, and the temptations are so easy to resist because sin, you start to see it as it really is, as the repulsive garbage that it actually is. And you're turned off by it. Because at that moment, righteousness seems attractive. Not only do you know it's good, but it actually seems attractive to you, and sin seems ugly to you. And that's when, the more that happens, the more the Christian life is automatic. See, God never designed for you to just go your whole life doing things you don't want to do and keeping yourself from doing the things you want to do. He wants you to have that perception such that your desires change so that you desire good things. Then you can do what you want. That's why he says that he satisfies our desires with good things in Psalm 37. So the way you think, the way things seem to you will determine what you desire. Now, how do you make righteousness seem attractive all the time? And the answer to that is set your mind on things above all the time. Time spent thinking from an earthly perspective makes you more and more responsive to your flesh. Time spent thinking from a spiritual perspective makes you more and more responsive to your spirit. So how do you gain control of your flesh? We get in Colossians 3 here four ways to gain mastery over your flesh. Way number one is set your mind on things above. Think about everything every day, every hour, throughout your life, from a spiritual, biblical perspective. I'm not saying only think about spiritual things. I'm thinking about everything from a spiritual perspective. So, things are really, over an extended period of time, you think that way, and then things seem the right way to you. Number two, the second thing that we saw in this passage is that you cut off the meal ticket to that bully Sarks. Remember, your flesh. You don't feed the flesh. Verse 5, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. You've died to this world. You've been released from the prison of the temporal. But the picture here is like, while you were locked up, remember we talked about, it's like they attach ropes to your arms and legs. And every time you try and get away, they draw you back. And there comes a time when you have to cut those ropes. You have to cut the ties. The ropes of the old life. And they're attached not to physical body parts, but to your desires. And so this passage calls us to cut those desires. And the way you do it is by refusing to feed the flesh. Remember, the word put to death means to cause something to die by means of atrophy. The idea is not to actively kill something as much as just to neglect it to the point where it just withers on the vine. That's what you do with your flesh. You refuse to feed the desires of your flesh, and your flesh will weaken, and you can keep it as weak as you want. But if you feed it, you just stoke those desires. And some people ask, why does God allow temptations to come into my life that are so hard? He knows I'm going to fall to them. And the answer is that those temptations don't come out of nowhere. The temptation comes into our hearts because our hearts have been reaching out towards that temptation for the last 6 months. I mean, if we are living a life basically saying, I'm available to be tempted, what do we expect? Why are we surprised when temptation comes? That's why Romans 13:14 says, clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ and do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh. Thinking about that will feed the flesh. It'll make it stronger. So we need to cultivate a habit of not feeding the flesh, not watching things, listening to things, reading things, thinking about things that feed the flesh. Now, some of those things are not in themselves sinful, but they tend to feed the flesh. And so we need to avoid those things. And then, so that's the second thing. You cut off the food source to your flesh. You cut off the source of strength. And then third, cultivate a habit of refusing to bow to the God of self. And we talked about that at length last week. Paul pinpoints the problem here as greed in verse 5. A greedy person is anyone who spends most of his time thinking about how to make himself feel better. And you need to kill covetousness in your life. Covetousness and greed are the same thing. You need to kill greed. You kill covetousness in your heart or it will kill you. It will destroy your life. You can no sooner satisfy a greedy heart than you can fill up a jar that has no bottom. It's absolutely unsatisfiable. And if you're not content with the way things are right now, that's greed. And the solution to greed is always contentment. I love the song I woke up to this morning as Tracy's alarm went off. The song was saying, I only caught one line, but it's a great line. Everything I need, I already have. That's a great line. Contentment is when you can say to God, I don't want anything other than what you have for me. I don't want anything other than what you're pleased to provide for me. How can you tell what God is pleased to provide for you right now? Well, you have it. That's how. You have it. And whatever He's pleased to provide you in the future, you'll get that. And that's all I want. That's an important prayer to pray to God. It'd be good to just pray that right now. Because that's a test of your faith. I mean, do you trust God's goodness enough to give up the things that you long for with the full confidence that God will grant you the degree of enjoyment and pleasure that He wants you to have, and that's the right amount for you? Do you trust God enough to do that? Or do you not trust Him, and so you're going to try and seek enough pleasure for yourself? If you want to know the real object of your worship, you just fill in the blank. Remember, in order to be satisfied, I have to have... fill in the blank. And don't fill in the blank for your wife. Oh, I know what my wife would put in there. Or your husband or your kid. Listen, this is for you. In order to be satisfied, I have to have what? And if it's anything other than God, then you're into idolatry and that idol must be deposed, put down. One of the ways that you can gain the upper hand on greed is to insert a delay between the impulse and the response. Just be sluggish in your obedience to your flesh. Learn how to procrastinate when it comes to responding to your flesh. Your flesh makes the demand. Your flesh says, okay, turn on the TV. And then if you just cultivate a habit of every time your flesh tells you, okay, I want to just flake out and watch TV, just say, fine, but you have to wait 5 minutes. 5 minutes. I'm going to wait 5 minutes, start myself, and then I'll flip on the TV. Or your body demands a snack. Say, okay, you can have a snack, but 2 minutes. 120 seconds, then I'll consider it best. That'll give your mind, at least give your mind a fighting chance against your flesh, so you can have a chance to at least think through things. If you can insert a delay in between the impulse and the response, that gives your mind and your heart a chance to think it through. But if you cultivate a habit of always instantly responding, as soon as your flesh makes a demand, then what Satan will do is he'll get you into a pattern of doing that, instantly responding to your flesh in non-sinful areas. And then as soon as he has you locked into that, all he has to do is get your flesh to desire some sinful thing and bam, you're right into it. Have you ever had that happen? Have you ever said, I don't want to do this sin. I want to stay away from it. And you do everything. You do Bible studies. You pray. You come up with systems. You write things on your hand. You do everything. And then you're walking along. The temptation hits. Bam! You just fall to it that fast. You say, how'd that happen? I don't even know what happened. The reason that happens that fast is because you've been bowing to the God of self and you're instantaneously obedient to the God of self. Insert the delay in there. The thing about the God of self is it tends to take over without you knowing. And so it's good to have a test. And that's the way we ended last week. We said it's like driving a car with a steering wheel that periodically comes disconnected. And you don't feel it when it becomes disconnected. You just have to, every once in a while you're driving down the road, test it, take a turn and see if anything happens to the car. If you turn and nothing happens, you just keep going the same way, you need to slam on the brakes to get the thing reconnected, right? We need to do the same thing with our lives. Self-control is the steering wheel of your life. It's the way that you control your life. And you need to be able to, every once in a while, take something that you like, see if you can go without it for a month. Or see if you can just come up with a test to see if you are in control of your appetites. Just turn the steering wheel and see if it's hooked up. Make sure some false god hasn't taken over. So, those are three things that you can do to gain mastery over the flesh. And then Paul adds a fourth thing that we want to look at this morning. But before he adds the fourth thing, he throws in a couple of motives. Just in case you need a little motivation at this point for why you should do this, because it's asking a lot. Motive number one, in verses 6 and 7, wrath. He interrupts his how-to lesson and says, listen, rid yourself of covetousness, greed, and the resulting sins that grow out of it, all sins of taking, because, verse 6, because of these things, the wrath of God is coming. The wrath of God is our motivation in this case. God gets violently angry over covetousness. And the reason he gets so angry over it is because it's the ultimate evil. Greed is the ultimate evil. We don't tend to understand that. Like the old priest said, he never once heard anybody confess the sin of covetousness. But the greatest good in the universe is the glorification of the true God as God, right? And so the greatest sin would be to elevate anything higher than Him. That's what idolatry is. So if the ultimate good is the supremacy of God, the ultimate sin is trying to lift myself higher than God. That's why God gets so angry over this particular sin of covetousness. So, since the wrath of God is coming, that's a motivation to avoid this sin of greed. But there's an interesting thing, and I didn't tell you about this last week because we ran out of time, but there's an alternate reading. There's some manuscripts that say the wrath of God is coming upon the children of disobedience. It's debatable whether that's in the original text. It could be borrowed from Ephesians 5. It's in some very early manuscripts. It's not in some even earlier ones. It's just a tough call to make. It seems to fit the grammar. Anyway, I'm not going to get into all that. We know that it's a valid statement, though, because it does appear in the exact same context in Ephesians 5. Now, think about the meaning of that. He's saying, if Paul said, get rid of these sins because the wrath of God is coming on everybody who commits these sins, well, that would be a motivation, right? Because we'd want to get rid of the sins so that we don't suffer the wrath of God. But instead he says, get rid of these sins because of these sins, the wrath of God is coming on the disobedient, those folks. How does that serve as a motivation for us? If you're a believer, you're not going to suffer the wrath of God ever. But the fact that God has wrath over those things should affect us. If somebody came to me and said, hey, did you know that every time you do that particular thing, it's so upsetting to your wife that she wants to cry for the next 4 days? I would respond and say, oh, no, I need to stop that. But I wouldn't say, oh, I need to stop that thing because she's going to get mad at me and divorce me or something like that. No, I would say, I want to stop that thing because if it's that upsetting to her, I can't stand the thought of me causing her that much pain. And that's the motivation that Paul's getting at here. We struggle against these sins, and we don't have to worry about the wrath of God if we're believers. But the fact that God has wrath over them, and the fact that people who are not in Christ will suffer unspeakable punishment because of those very things, the greed, should tell us something about how serious it is to God. So, that's our first motive. This is a very serious matter to God. Second motive is in verse 7. He says, you used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived. Those things are the things that you fled from when you became a Christian. And he's just reminding us of that. That's a great thing to remember once in a while in your life. Because those things attract us, and we need to remind ourselves why we dumped those things in the first place. Literally, he says, you used to walk in them when you lived in them. We don't live in that way anymore, and we don't walk that way anymore. But as Christians, sometimes we stumble back into that. And he's saying, that's not the pattern. Now you have a totally different walk. Why would you go back to that? Don't you remember why you fled from it in the first place? Spurgeon has a great quote on this. He says this, Christian, what have you to do with sin? Has it not cost you enough already? Burnt child, will you play in the fire? What? When you have already been between the jaws of the lion, will you step a second time into his den? Have you not had enough of the old serpent? Did he not poison all your veins once? And will you play upon the hole of the asp and put your hand on the snake's den a second time? Oh, be not so insane, so foolish. Did sin ever yield you any real pleasure? Did you find solid satisfaction in it? If so, go back to your old drudgery and wear the chains again if it delights you. But inasmuch as sin did never give you what it promised to bestow, but deluded you with lies, do not be snared a second time by the old fowler. Be free and let the remembrance of your ancient bondage forbid you to enter the net again. That last statement is great. Let that memory of your ancient bondage forbid you to ever enter into the net again. Don't you remember that there's a reason why you turned your back on all that stuff to begin with? So, those are a couple of motivations. It's a very serious matter to God. It's something that was a serious matter to you when you became a Christian. That's why you dumped this stuff. Why return to it? Okay, so then now we're going to get the fourth thing. Number of things, reason, way that, I mean, these are ways that you can get rid of, gain control over your flesh, gain mastery over your flesh. Number one, set your mind on things above. Number two, cut off the meals to your flesh. Don't feed the flesh. Number three, cultivate a habit of refusing to bow to the God of self. And then now, verse 7, he says, you used to walk in these ways in the way you once, in life you once lived. Now you must rid yourself of, or literally, strip off all these things, all such things. Strip them off like clothes. Take off the old sins like you would take off old clothes. It's just simply a decision. He's saying, make the decision to remove those sins from your life. Use your will. Now, we understand that willpower alone can never change your life in any way. It won't do the job. That's why we end up breaking almost every resolution we ever make, because resolve alone does nothing to your flesh. And we understand that, don't we? I mean, if we try and use willpower and we have constant failure. You have to have 1, 2, and 3. You have to set your mind on things above in a continual pattern. You have to cut off the meals and weaken the flesh, and you have to cultivate a habit of refusing to bow to self. That's essential. However, there is a role for willpower. That's part of the process. There does come a point when just say no is a factor. But only after you've your will has become stronger than your flesh. And the way that your will can become stronger than your flesh is if you've gone through those first three. However, once you do those, then the will is a very important part. It's interesting in verse 8. Look at verse 8. He says, but now you must rid yourself of all such things as these. Now that's interesting. The reason that's interesting is because usually Paul says, listen folks, you used to be X, now you're Y. But here he doesn't say that. He says, you used to be X, but so now get rid of X. After having been delivered from sin, sin still remains. Deliverance from sin is a process that starts when you're born again, goes all the way until the resurrection. You don't live that way anymore. You don't walk that way anymore. However, you still have those things draped around you like old clothes, and you have to simply make a decision to strip them off. Commands like this totally destroy the idea of quietism. We've talked about that before. Quietism is the idea that there's no effort involved in sanctification in the Christian life. Here he calls us to put forth effort, make a decision. And it seems like a very external thing, the imagery of just taking off clothes. Yes, we do need to attack sin at the root. And yes, sanctification is a work of God. And yes, we can only be changed from the inside out, never from the outside in. However, there's a close connection between your inside and your outside. And while all of those things are true, still a major part of the godly life is just simply deciding to do good things and deciding not to do bad things. There is an external component. You've been given a new position. You need to dress the part. If you had a job at a garbage dump that involved wading through a lot of trash, you would wear rags to that job. If you got promoted from that to be some board member of the company that owns that disposal site, it's not appropriate to wear those same clothes. You have to change clothes. You need to dress appropriately to your new position. And so in verses 8 and 9, he gives us another list of things to strip off. And that's another interesting thing, just as an aside. If you look into ancient literature, it's very common to see lists of vices or virtues, just like Paul gives all the time. And whenever you see two lists, one list, a comment, and another list, like you have here, very often the second list is subordinate to the first list. That is, the first list is what's really important, most important. And I think that's fascinating here because the second list, hate, anger, rage, all that kind of stuff, lying, all these bad sins that even the world recognizes as bad sins, those are secondary. And greed and covetousness is primary to get rid of. Our society will agree that anger and hate and rage are all wrong. They won't agree, though, that self-love is wrong. The problem, though, is failure to eliminate self-love out of your heart will inevitably lead to anger and rage and lying and slander. The world wants to hang on to self-love. They don't want to give it up. But they want everyone to be nice to each other. They want everyone to get along and be friendly and loving. It doesn't happen. It'll never happen because when you bow to the god of self, self gets spoiled and self gets very upset when someone comes along and steps on its toes, which inevitably happens. And so as long as you have self-love, you will always have anger and hatred and rage. And so he says, get rid of these things. Anger and rage, pretty much the same thing. They're just two different words for anger. Basically synonyms. When they're used together, probably describes the whole process of anger. Everything from the very beginning on the inside, the feelings on the inside, all the way to the external expression. Some people say, you know, it's only the external expression that's wrong. Here, this covers everything. And then malice is the third word. Just talks about a negative disposition. This is the way you feel, the way your disposition towards those you're mad at. It's almost a desire to see harm come to them, a malicious kind of spite. And it's the motive behind all the hateful speech. The first three things are the motive. The next three in the list are the what comes out of your mouth as a result. And before we look at that, let's just spend the rest of our time here talking about anger, because this is so important. So many people struggle with anger. There's a lot of debate over whether it's appropriate for Christians to be angry. Some people say, you know, on the one hand, it seems like a negative emotion. It seems to cause problems. On the other hand, it's so natural. It's so part of being human. It's hard to imagine not being angry. And so people are a little ambivalent whether it's right or wrong. Jesus settled the whole issue in Matthew 5:21. He said, have you not heard, or you have heard, it was said to the people long ago, do not murder. Anyone who murders be subject to judgment. But I tell you, anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. And anyone who says to his brother, Raka, calling him a name, is answerable to the Sanhedrin, but anyone who says to him, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. So that settles it. It's wrong to be angry. We're forbidden, as Christians, to be angry. We are never permitted to be angry, except with the one exception of righteous anger. Now, what's that? What is righteous anger? It's actually not a biblical phrase at all. You don't find it in the Bible. We're never commanded in the Bible to be angry. However, there are some hints in the Bible that there is some form of anger over sin that is appropriate. Some level of anger over sin that's appropriate. Psalm 119:53 says, indignation grips me because of the wicked who have forsaken your law. He sees the wicked and it makes him mad. Jeremiah 15:17, Jeremiah says, I sat alone because your hand was on me and you have filled me with indignation. And in 2 Corinthians 7, we've been reading this week, it says, see what this godly sorrow and repentance has produced in you. What indignation. There's a certain anger at sin that comes with repentance. And there is one time during Christ's earthly life that the Bible actually attributes anger to Jesus. In Mark 3:4, it's the only time. It says, then Jesus asked them, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to kill, or evil, to save life or to kill? But they remained silent. And he looked around them, at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. He was angry because they wouldn't, there was a guy there was hurting, he needed healing, and they wouldn't agree that it was okay to heal him on the Sabbath because they're more concerned about their dumb rules than they were about people, and that made Jesus angry. It also stands to reason that he was probably pretty unhappy when he cleared the temple. It doesn't actually say that he was angry, but we can assume that, I think, pretty safely. Judging from his actions. So in anger, when is anger righteous anger? When is it sinful anger? If we just look at Jesus' example, it's pretty easy, isn't it? Because it's very clear with Jesus, when he was angry when other people were being harmed or when God was being defamed, God the Father. But he never responded with anger when somebody harmed him. So So when people defile the temple, he was in a rage. When somebody doesn't even care about his fellow brother, he would get mad. But when somebody hurt him, whenever it was directed at him, now that's also directed against God, but if he was involved at all, he wouldn't respond in anger. And you can just watch him on the cross and see that. His response was never angry. Father, forgive them. And that's our example. Righteous anger is when you're angry because of sin, some other sin that's not directed at you. Sinful anger is when you're angry at sin directed at you. When somebody steps on your toes and you respond in anger, that's always sinful. That's forbidden for the Christian. Always. Some people have thought righteous anger is when your anger is justified because what they did against me is so bad, it justifies a little anger. No. Doesn't matter how bad it is. If anybody sins any sin against you, it's wrong to be angry. Turn to Ephesians 4. Just before Colossians, go back a couple of books. Selfish anger is always sin. We need to see that. We need to just get that into our skulls because we tend to think that there's some leeway there. There's not. We have this sense that somehow some amount of anger, or at least a few moments of anger, is okay if we've been wronged. And we think, you know, as long as I forgive in the next few hours or so, then I haven't really sinned. That's not true. The moment you're angry, you are in sin. From that moment until the time that you're not angry anymore. And we've been told that it's impossible not to be angry at certain offenses, but where is that in the Bible? Where does the Bible tell us that? Look at verse 26 of Ephesians 4. He says, in your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Some people have said, in the King James, it says, be angry and do not sin. Some people have tried to say, see, hey, there it says it's okay to be angry. In fact, it commands it. We know that's not the correct interpretation, because just a few verses later, in verse 31, he condemns all anger. Says, get rid of all of it, every kind of it. And Jesus said in Matthew 5:22 that we're forbidden to be angry. So it's not commanding us to be angry. The NIV translation is good. It says if you do sin by being angry, don't sin further by holding on to your anger. Get rid of it. And if you hold on to your anger, basically what you're doing is giving the devil a foothold, literally giving place to the devil, giving him a place in your life. If you have a temper, that means you have a room in your life marked devil. You're basically inviting the devil into your life. And God knows us. He knows we'll try and rationalize our way out of anything, and we do. We'll never admit to being angry as Christians. We'll always just come up with another word for it, right? I'm not really angry. I'm just disappointed. Or, you know, I'm just frustrated. I'm not angry, but I'm, you know, annoyed, or I'm impatient, or I'm irritated, or whatever term you use. Paul sort of anticipates that. He says, okay, whatever you want to call it, verse 31, get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, brawling, slander, every form of malice, whatever you want to call it, just get rid of it all. Bitterness it refers to having some feeling of resentfulness, bitter anger towards somebody, just resenting someone. You see him and you just kind of frown. Rage, anger, brawling, it should be translated yelling, that's the idea of yelling, screaming. Slander, malice, get rid of it all. People get mad in a lot of different ways. They express it in a lot of different ways. Some people give you the silent treatment, some people just, you can't even tell they're mad, they keep it all inside. Some people fly in a rage. Some people are just quiet, they turn around, walk away, slam the door, like that. Welcome back, those of you who are drifting. Paul says, just get rid of it all. So how do you do it? How do you get rid of your anger? How can you rid yourself of this sin? I mean, we know what our life should be like, right? We know our speech should be kind and salted with grace, and we know our home should be loving, and yet, next thing you know, we find ourselves yelling at our kids, or fuming at someone in the church, or nursing some grudge, or being cool towards our spouse. We know what we should be like, and yet we have a problem with anger. We don't like the result of our anger, but we can't seem to get rid of it. Let's see how we can get rid of it. Let's apply these four principles that we just learned to anger and see how they work. Want to get rid of anger? Thing number one, remember, set your mind on things above. How does that help? If you look at things from a temporal, earthly, physical perspective, how does that cause you to be more angry? Well, when you think about things from a temporal perspective, you look around and all you see are people. You don't see God, and you don't see heaven. All you see is just people. There's you, and then there's all the other people. And from that perspective, it sure seems like you better watch out for yourself in this rat race, or you're just going to get stepped on, right? And if you don't fight for your rights, people are going to take advantage of you. So purely from a physical standpoint, it seems like you should watch out for your rights. That's the way things seem. And if you're concerned about your rights, I promise you, you're going to have a temper problem. That's what causes anger, is when someone steps on what you think are your rights. You feel like you have the right to be treated a certain way, somebody treats you worse than that, and you get mad. You feel like you have the right to your possessions, to keep them and to have them in good working order, everything. Then somebody comes along, takes one or breaks one, and you get mad. You think you have the right to a certain amount of relaxation, your spouse intrudes on that, you get mad at your spouse. You feel like you have a right to a happy home, you don't have a happy home, you get mad. You feel like you have the right to a certain kind of a family or a certain kind of a spouse, you don't have that kind, and you get mad maybe even at God. On the other hand, suppose you have your mind set on things above. From a spiritual perspective, a biblical perspective, you take God into consideration on a regular basis, what will happen? You'll begin to see yourself as a slave of Jesus Christ. You belong to Him, you're answerable only to Him, you have no rights at all as a slave. Slaves have no rights. No rights. And you're a voluntary slave of Christ. And on top of that, you can see that He controls everything, right? You understand that He's in control of everything and that He dearly loves you and that He's promised to take care of you. So is there any chance that you can ultimately be taken advantage of to your ultimate harm? No. Is there any chance that you won't be taken care of by God? No, no chance at all. On top of that, as you think about God, it becomes very obvious to you that you don't own anything, right? You're just a steward that's taking care of His things and you own nothing. You just take care of your master's things the best you can. So if one of them gets broken or stolen or lost outside of your control, it's no loss to you. You're... situation hasn't changed. Your financial portfolio hasn't changed at all because your financial portfolio, your situation of somebody taking care of you is a very wealthy provider has promised to meet your every need to His according to His wisdom. And that hasn't changed. It's just because some possession goes out of your possession, you've lost nothing. If the master decides to take one of His things out of your care and put it in someone else's care, that's his business. What business is that of mine? That's just one less thing I have to worry about being faithful with. I mean, if God gives me a nice car, and He controls everything, and He sends along a drunk driver to smash that thing up out of the blue, what business is it of mine if God wants to smash up His own car? And if He calls me to some calling that requires that I have a car, it's His problem to worry about how to get me a car to do what He called me to do. And if He wants to... it's no problem for him to shuffle one of his other cars into my garage one way or another. If you spend day after day, hour after hour, year after year, thinking of, from that perspective, you'll get to the point where it doesn't seem to you like you own anything. You know you don't own anything, but it seems like that, and then you'll realize you don't deserve any certain level of treatment because you're a slave, and it'll seem that way to you, and at that point, there's nothing anybody can ever do to make you mad. There's nothing they can do to you to make you angry. And that should be your goal, really, to be unoffendable. Oh, for a church of unoffendable people. People that just won't take up offense at some personal thing. We pretty much have that now. I think, it's great where we are now. I don't know why. It could be that offendable people are instantaneously offended by me already when they come in the first Sunday and they never come back. I don't know. But you folks are great. But we need to stay on that line. There's nothing worse than being in a church where everybody's always mad at everybody. And they just get offended. You should never be the type of person that somebody can accidentally offend you. That is ridiculous. And that's why our understanding of God's sovereignty is so crucial when it comes to eliminating temper. If you have a temper problem, you probably have a limited understanding of the sovereignty of God. You have to understand that doctrine. God's control. If it's your job to sweep the floor, and it's my job to mop the floor, and I show up with my mop, and I show up and there's dirt everywhere, you forgot. How am I going to respond? If I have an earthly perspective, a temporal perspective, I'm going to look at that thing and I'm going to see it as something you did to create an inconvenience for me, and I'm going to get mad. But if I have an understanding of the sovereignty of God, and I see it as something that came from His hand rather than your hand, I'm not going to get mad because I know that He only does good things, never bad things. Do you understand that? So I see the mess on the floor, and I just respond, oh, evidently you want me to sweep and mop today. Evidently, God, you want me to miss my appointment that I was going to do after I quit mop this floor. Yes, Lord, whatever. I mean, I trust you. And I can grab that broom with a huge smile on my face as I begin to, while I'm sweeping, think about whatever reason he has for wanting me to both sweep and mop today. I don't know what the reason is, but I know he only does perfectly good things, and the more I get to think about how good it must be, the bigger my smile gets. And you're not even involved. Sovereignty of God is crucial. So, number one, conquer temper, set your mind on things above. Number two, oh man, we got to go fast. Okay, cut off the meal tickets to the flesh. Don't feed the flesh. The flesh wants you to spend 90% of your time thinking about how to make it comfortable, right? If you do that, then the result of that is whenever anything happens that creates discomfort in your life, it's the end of the world. And you get mad. Someone comes along, does something, it results in some inconvenience for you, you get angry. That's because you've been feeding the flesh. If you develop a pattern of refusing to concern yourself very much with your comfort or how you feel, the less and less it'll become a priority. And when how I feel is no longer a big deal, big issue to me, then you can't make me mad by creating some inconvenience or discomfort for me, because that's not even an issue for me. But if I've been feeding the flesh, I'll have an ultra sensitivity to the fact that you've just inconvenienced me, and I'll get mad. So stop feeding the flesh. And then number three, cultivate a habit of refusing to bow to the God of self. Now how does this help us with anger? Well, if every single time my flesh comes up with an impulse, I instantaneously obey that, then the first sign of someone doing something that inconveniences me is anger, just like that, real fast. It'll just come up. Because the God of self has been violated, and it's not used to that. You ever around people that have a real fast temper? You know that? I mean, they're just fine, they're happy, there's nothing wrong with them, they're in a good mood. One thing happens and bam, they're just in a rage. I mean, their face just instantly turns red and they're yelling or whatever, swearing something. You know, that happens. The reason they're like that is because they have been, as a pattern of life, bowing to the altar of self. And you just happen to do one little thing against their precious God. Self. And they instantly react before their mind or heart has any chance to even think. However, on the other hand, if you've been sluggish in responding to the impulses of your flesh, not bowing to the God of flesh, and you have that built-in delay, it gives your mind a chance to kick in and understand these principles. So, you set your mind on things above as a pattern, you cut off the feeding of the flesh, you cultivate a habit of refusing to bow to the God of self, you insert that delay in there, and then number four, you just make the decision. You say, what's the decision when it comes to anger? Very easy. You decide to forgive. Just instantly decide to forgive. As soon as they offend you, say, I'm going to forgive right now. And I've got great news for you. I mean, I've got great news for some of you that have never heard this. You can forgive. Forgiving is not as hard as people have made it out to be. Everyone in this room is capable of instantaneously forgiving any sin. All you have to do is know the principles of what Scripture says about how to forgive. But you can, it's not true, the lie that some of you have been told that you have to go through a long process before you're actually ready to forgive. So how do you forgive? I mean, and some people have said, well, wait a minute, when I forgive someone, isn't that tacitly sort of saying it's okay what they did? And I don't want to convey that because it's not okay. What if you want to forgive, but you just can't seem to make yourself forgive? The thoughts just constantly come back. What exactly is forgiveness? We need to devote a whole sermon to that. So, and it's not going to be next week either, because this comes up in verse 13. You have to make sure when we get to verse 13, you're all here, because this information about, we introduced it at the retreat. Remember when we were up at the retreat? This is so important for you to understand this. We need to devote a whole message to it. And so, whenever we get to keep track here, and whenever we get to verse, in fact, just come every week. Because you never know when verse 13 will come up. I might go in a leap and go real fast over some verses, so just come every week. But you got to be here when we get to verse 13, because this matter of forgiveness is absolutely crucial.